Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Deborah Becker. We're going to begin today with Massachusetts' cautious move into the world of virtual schools. Today, education officials approved the state's second online academy.
The Education Collaborative's Connections Academy Commonwealth Virtual School will be based in Dedham and will enroll up to 2,000 students.
About 300,000 students across the country are enrolled in virtual schools. They offer more flexible schedules for, say, kids with athletic or artistic commitments, or perhaps with medical or behavioral issues.
But some education leaders worry about the school's mixed academic record. They've also raised questions about accountability and oversight of virtual academies.
To learn more about how virtual schools run, we contacted Carl Tolona. He's executive director of the state's first online K-12 school, the Massachusetts Virtual Academy in Greenfield. A 2012 report by the New England Center for Investigative Reporting showed that some of the MCAS scores for students at that school were among the lowest in the state. But Tolona says the school is making improvements.
The state has come around, too, and this is not just for virtual schools, but for everyone to say, you know, we need to look at other things besides test scores. We need to look at growth. We need to look at, you know, how many students have you gotten from your warning or needs improvement into the proficient range. I think the idea of just looking at your MCAS score and saying, this is where you are, is no longer a valid point.
Mm-hmm. And you have about 500 students right now, about 14 or 15 teachers, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
What's the average salary for a teacher?
I'm not 100% sure. I don't work for K-12, I work for the board.
Mm. And so just so we have it clear, K-12, though, partners with the Greenfield School Committee. Can you explain what the relationship is with K-12 in terms of overseeing or helping to run Massachusetts Virtual Academy?
K-12 provides the curriculum, and they have a head program administrator here that works hand-in-hand with me. Any concerns that I have, I talk to him, and we get it straightened out. And, you know, but I report to the board who runs the school. Mm-hmm. You know, I think if you go out to Ohio or out to the Midwest where they have K-12 run schools, I mean, I think it's a different entity than what you'd see out there. You know, we're run by the Board of Trustees who have hired me to run the school.
The New York Times had done an article about K-12, which was rather critical and said that many of the teachers are not paid very well. Low 30s, I think, to start is sort of the starting teacher salary. Many of them supervising well over 150 students online. How do you assure the public that that's not happening at Massachusetts Virtual Academy in Greenfield?
The school is not run by K-12. The school is run by a board of trustees and who have hired me as the executive director.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, our teachers are excellent teachers, and I feel that our students are getting the services that they need.
Now, there was a new state law that the governor signed regarding oversight of virtual schools, and he said that the state would oversee schools like Massachusetts Virtual Academy. The Greenfield School Committee had some concerns, namely that the school was no longer going to be under local control but under state control. But there were also concerns expressed. I believe I read a quote by the Greenfield School Committee member Mary Ellen Calderwood. She voted against submitting that proposal, and she said, right now this is a private corporation making a lot of money on public money, and there's very little oversight. What do you say to people who might be concerned that she's making comments like that, and how do you address those concerns?
Well, I think everyone has their own opinion. At the end of the day, my decisions are based on the welfare of our students. I'm not in this business for anything else but for the welfare of my students.
Do you think that we're sort of at maybe at this new point in trying to understand how to use technology in education? And that's why maybe there are these questions, and you know, of who might benefit the most from this type of learning and how we implement it.
If you think about education and the educational system, you know, maybe it's been around in some form or another, you know, 200 years maybe, you know, in some official, you know, official form, maybe 180 years or something like that. Virtual school's been around for 15. So talk to me in 150 years. And, you know, I don't think that you're going to have the same, you know, I've always said that this school serves, I don't know, 1% of the population. And for that 1% of the population who choose this school, it's been a positive experience for them.
All right. Carl Tolona, who is principal of the Massachusetts Virtual Academy in Greenfield, the first virtual academy in the state of Massachusetts. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
For more on virtual schools, we turn now to Chad Dontremont. He is executive director of the Rennie Center for Education, Research, and Policy in Cambridge. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, with today's vote in favor of this second online school in Massachusetts, it appears that virtual schools are pretty much here to stay. What do you think needs to be done to make sure that students are learning in this type of environment? And are there other student achievement measures, as we heard Mr. Tolona measure, that should be taken into account when we're looking at the record of virtual schools?
Well, first and foremost, I think it's important to acknowledge that technology has a critical role to play as we think about advancing our educational system, that moving from what's often referred to as a factory model of schooling, where students all move through the same course load at the same time, to one that can be individualized and competency-based, meaning emphasis on skill rather than completion, is important, and technology can help with that. But with that evolution comes new models, and how we often assess schools through basic things like student attendance to actual assessment outcomes, if they're all progressing at different rates, becomes much more challenging. So it's important to have checkpoints to make sure there's actual interactions between the students and the adults who are responsible for guiding their learning, be they teachers, parents, or mentors, as they go through a virtual school.
So do we need to rethink the way we assess student progress as well in these kinds of environments? I'm assuming here that we're talking about students who don't necessarily fare very well in a traditional brick-and-mortar classroom to begin with. So how do we assess what's going on and how they may or may not be benefiting?
You know, it's an interesting question. In fact, some of the most progressive schools in using technology are those that work with high-need students, students who have dropped out of traditional school settings, who have to work during the day to support families, who have health and mental health issues. And so creating schools that support those students, well, you certainly do not want to remove academic standards and make sure that there's a baseline body of knowledge that students acquire to be successful in the workplace. Recognizing that their progress might be different, making sure that they stay engaged and enrolled in the school is very important. And we need to develop ways of attending to the whole development of a child, not just academic learning, but social and emotional need, especially for at-risk students, to make sure that their schooling experience is meaningful, be it traditional or virtual.
Hmm. Now, what do we know about how things have happened in other states? We know in Massachusetts we've been rather slow to catch on to the online academy, if you will, and they're much more prevalent in states like Ohio and Florida. What do we know about their track record in those states?
Well, I think with any new reform, it's a little bit difficult to jump too quickly to whether or not a new model, in this case virtual schooling, is higher performing or lower performing than traditional schools. What we found across the literature is that virtual schooling can often provide student outcomes that are similar to what they learn in traditional schools, but there is great variability. So it really depends on the quality of the individual school, not the reform itself.
Mm. And what about sort of the role in school and the structure of school in a child's education, the socialization that goes on, the playground, the gymnasium, and things like that? And how important is that? And how are students missing something if they don't have that?
Sure. No, it's an important question. I mean, one of the things that was touched on earlier in the story was the role of the teacher in schools and understanding that in many of the most successful schooling models, be they turnaround traditional public schools, be they charter schools, be they just high-performing schools in a suburban community, a strong school leader and high-quality teachers play a critical role. So if you're changing the teacher-student ratio, if the school leader themselves plays a different role and may not be all that familiar with the students who are in the school, you need to rethink what are the support structures that are replacing that. Separately, what you've also brought up is how do you provide socialization experiences? We know from research in other states, research that I've done in California and Pennsylvania, former homeschoolers often attend virtual schools. Mm-hmm. And while they can create vibrant communities that they're connected through their homeschool network, if part of what we want school, public schools to provide is citizenship, that should be an important component of any schooling experience.
Mm. And what about these private for-profit companies getting involved? And there have been a lot of questions about the way that things have been run by some of these companies, and questions from some of the folks in Greenfield about whether these companies are making money off public dollars for education. Does it taint the process, and should there be a different way of doing this, would you say?
Well, I think it's really a question for the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education, the charter school authorizers. At the end of the day, if a charter school or a virtual school, rather, excuse me, is presenting an application that is deemed to be high quality with a proven track record, that should be most important. I think what is important to suss out if there is a management organization that may have a for-profit agenda, is their commitment to student learning the number one priority of what they're providing to the creation of a virtual school?
Mm-hmm. And we mentioned teachers briefly. You know, mm-hmm. many of these teachers are certified in these schools but not unionized, although there is a unionized fight, I think, for one of the large virtual learning providers going on right now because of what's happening with teacher loads and teacher hours. Is that something that you think is going to change, that we might see a larger unionization effort? Should there be unionized teachers in these schools?
Well, like any reform, I think it depends on how rapidly it grows. I think the number one issue should be that anyone who is identified as a teacher in any school meets important quality criteria, so their instruction is actually benefiting students in their learning and in their development.
It's here to stay, then. Do you think it can benefit most students?
Well, as I think that's been pointed out, it's actually serving a very small minority of students mm-hmm. right now. So while technology is here to stay and new models of schooling, particularly those that combine brick-and-mortar schools with internet-based opportunities, are here to stay, I think we need to learn more about pure virtual learning experiences.
And the way we would learn more would be?
Well, to study them fully, to assess how students are progressing as they go through, and if authorizers for virtual schooling experiences deem them of high quality, it's fine to authorize them and hold them accountable.
Okay. Chad Dontremont, Executive Director of the Rennie Center for Education and Policy, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Stay with us. Coming up on our program, The Dream of the Great American Novel and Why It Still Haunts Us. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.